Thanks again for listening to the Book Club at 91.7 WVXU and WMUB. I'm Mark Purcell. You've probably heard or read about Louisville's Bingham family, known for their media empire. But there's one member of the family you probably have not heard of, because there are some family members who had not heard of Henrietta. A new book changes all that. Emily Bingham is the great-niece of Henrietta Bingham and has written a book called Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham, and she's joining me on the phone. Emily, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
I love in the introduction how you talk about stumbling upon the story of Henrietta, who you've not heard about before, when you named your daughter Henrietta and your father came by and said, "Oh, why'd you do that? She was a $3 bill." Talk about how you discovered or began to discover the story of your great aunt, Henrietta Bingham.
So it wasn't too long after my daughter was born that I was at a dinner at a nice restaurant with some old family friends, and my an older woman, Louisville sort of doyenne, turned to me and said, "Well, you know, I have a story about your great aunt, the first Henrietta." And she proceeded to tell me about her mother entering the grand, you know, entryway of the Louisville Country Club and taking off her coat and handing it to the people in the checking room. And then as they were all getting ready to go up this wide staircase, a debutante shooting out of the powder room and leaning over the banister and shouting to the assembled guests, "Henrietta Bingham just kissed me on the lips." When I heard this story, I realized that there was 80-year-old gossip that no one had a chance to tell, and it was like that for years. People were just coming to me with these offerings of stories, photographs, beautiful adventuring, cigarette cases lined with diamonds, and I just, for a long time, just thought this was kind of fun, and eventually it felt like Henrietta was reaching out for me.
Well, she is described in the book as tall, dark-haired, violet-eyed, very charismatic, very seductive voice. She was quite a piece of work when she was running around the world in 1920s and the 1930s, but it all seemed to stem from her childhood and when she was, 12 years old, when her mother died in an auto accident.
She grew up in downtown Louisville in a beautiful Victorian neighborhood, but her grandmother had a country house, and on weekends the family would sometimes head out there for the day or a picnic. And her father that day was actually heading out on a train to Cincinnati for a legal case he was going to be sitting in the following day, and he was an attorney. So his train took off, and the family took off in the car, and they came to a crossing. And Henrietta's uncle stopped and wiped his glasses and then put them back on, and everyone thought he saw the interurban that was coming, but he didn't. And their car was thrown around a pole, and Henrietta's mother broke her back instantly, almost died. And ironically, her father's L&N train to Cincinnati passed the scene because they were on parallel tracks, not knowing, of course, that his wife was dying. And seeing that, you know, happen before her eyes was clearly traumatic, and it happened at a time in her life when, you know, she was adolescent and already a seductive person, but her father came through that as already he was a pretty needy guy, but having lost his wife, whom he depended so much emotionally, I think he turned to Henrietta for support and succor.
I'm speaking with Emily Bingham. Her book is Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. You can learn more at wvxu.org about the book. And talk about Robert Worth Bingham, the Kentucky newspaper publisher and politician who had quite a personality. And, I guess he was just as charismatic as Henrietta, you could say.
Well, they definitely shared some traits, and they wanted to be loved and needed to be loved badly. But he came to Kentucky from North Carolina. He was part of an eminent, though not wealthy, educator family that had run a series of preparatory schools since the late 1700s in that state. But he didn't want to be a schoolmaster for his life. He had much bigger sights set on bigger things. And he found a woman visiting Asheville, something of an heiress who came through town when it was quite sort of the spa at the turn of the century, and hitched his wagon to her star. And she brought him to Louisville and helped launch his career as a lawyer and a politician. And he ran for office many times. He never succeeded. Well, he succeeded once in being elected to a county judgeship, but he had a lot of failures on that front, which he blamed primarily on the corrupt political machines that were running the political scene in Louisville. But anyway, he really didn't achieve the kind of renown that that he had hoped for until after his first wife's death and his remarriage to the wealthiest woman in the country. And she was widow of Standard Oil founder and Florida East Coast developer Henry Flagler. And Mary Lilly brought a great deal of money to the marriage. And unfortunately, with that boon financially came a great deal of humiliation and shame, because after she died, soon following their marriage, he was actually accused of having a hand in her death and forcing her to sign a codicil to benefit him. So it became a deep scandal, and I think the scar of the first wife's death was just opened up all over again with this national headlines about his besmirching his honor. And Henrietta was sort of there to try to make him feel better after that, too.
Well, these are your ancestors, Emily. But some of these secrets are shocking. What did it feel like sharing some of these stories? I know some had been heard before, but certainly Henrietta's had not. But everyone knew her story. Just put it between the covers of a book. But what was it like revealing these family faults, I suppose you could say?
Well, I guess two things. I'm an historian. I'm a trained historian. I have a doctorate, and I know how to do research, and I know how to look at facts. And also, hopefully, I hope I write with enough passion and style for any reader to enjoy. But this is history. I'm not making it up. I'm not embellishing it. I could have written this as a novel, but I choose, it's profoundly important to me that we think about how complex real lives are in the past. And that, I believe, spreads to any family. I mean, there are members of anyone's family tree who are not talked about, or who are only talked about in these glancing ways, often repetitive ways. And I think we all do well. I'm not trying to say I went out to air dirty laundry. I didn't, because I thought this was going to be much more a separate story than it became of the families. But I think when we don't challenge those silences, Mark, we actually misunderstand who we are and where we're from. And around those holes and those silences form a lot of actions of our family members that shaped us. But if we don't know what they are, we don't know how they've been shaped.
The old adage about if we don't remember our history, we're doomed to repeat it too. But Henrietta, let's talk a little bit about Henrietta and her jazz age life, because, boy, irrepressible, I think, doesn't even begin to describe Henrietta and her activity. I mean, going to Europe and driving, cars around with her friends and partying in many places. She was irrepressible.
Well, many of your listeners will know Virginia Woolf, of course, one of the great 20th century novelists. And one of Henrietta's amazing fortunes was to arrive at age 22 in London, post-World War I London, where a group of remarkable intellectuals and artists had convened around Virginia Woolf and her sister, the painter Vanessa Bell. And these were some of the great minds of the day. They also happened to be devoted to breaking every taboo around Victorian manners and morals. And so Henrietta's appearance in this crowd as a well, her first night meeting many of them was in the Garrett studio of Duncan Grant and Vanessa Bell. And she brought to a 30th birthday party of one of their friends a beautiful Southern caramel cake, and she also brought a basket full of mixers to mix the kind of cocktails that these people had never had before. And when the Victrola wound down, they needed something to entertain the group, and she took up the mandolin and started singing a work song about a water boy bringing water to a chain gang. I mean, this was a Southern debutante with an incredibly alluring persona, singing in the voice of an African American, you know, laborer, maybe even a slave laborer or a convict laborer, and it just blew them all away. One man and one woman fell for her that night, and neither of them got over her for years afterwards, and this was just the beginning.
And we're talking about London and New York and in Louisville, you know, as you say in the book, and I read, I think, in the New York Times article about the book, about anywhere she alighted, she bewitched scores of men and women, mostly women. And this was part of what you examine here are the attitudes towards homosexuality there in the 1920s and 1930s. And Henrietta seemed to enjoy that little bit of lull between the storms, I guess you could say, when it came to sexuality, right?
That's a great way of putting it. She sort of rode a wave that came along. She came of age exactly with the 1920s, having been born in 1901, and she loved the music of the 20s and was personally devoted to promoting black music wherever she went, and befriended many of the amazing performers of that time who were bringing jazz music and blues from just being sort of a peculiarity of a certain, you know, subset of the population to being a complete international sensation of, you know, American cultural production. So she was really taken with that, and music, that music spoke to her, and I think partly why it spoke to her was that the restlessness, that champagne-fueled restlessness that jazz helped express, but also the blues, which she felt deeply and never totally overcame. So, you know, there are wonderful scenes in Harlem where she's introducing her lovers to these performers and performances in speakeasies and nightclubs and, you know, parties in Harlem apartments. John Houseman, one of her great companions, told of a night that she drove him uptown in her open Chrysler with this massive silver flask sitting between them and showed him all of the Harlem Renaissance in one night. And he said later that just remembering sitting next to her in a car like that was to bring orgasms of uncontrollable weeping over himself. So, and the sexuality part, I mean, she just, it was a brief window, as you say, and I think it kind of went, you know, it was a time where no one could talk about sex, period, barely, and we were just beginning to have language largely via Freud to even start talking about it. And that's why the Bloomsbury group, the group around Virginia Woolf that she joined in so enthusiastically, was so unusual, and so were some of these performers in Harlem. I mean, some of the great blues women of the 1920s are, you know, known for having also toyed with these very dangerous boundaries around sexuality, and she was really doing the same.
Well, Emily Bingham, we barely scratched the surface on the adventures of your great aunt Henrietta Bingham. But when we were talking about family and family secrets, you said we have to learn about ourselves. What did you learn about yourself as you were writing about your great aunt?
Well, I certainly learned that I could be really dogged, because this took a lot of work. And it was an excavation. I mean, she had really been deeply buried for 50 years almost. And I had to create a story without the voice of the main character, because she did not leave diaries. And even the letters that she wrote to the people who loved her so deeply, I think when she left those people, they were so scarred that they either destroyed her letters to save their own souls, or they were trying to protect themselves and her from, you know, the negative social scrutiny that might come upon them if someone discovered this evidence. So it was really a challenge, and I sometimes felt as if I were dancing in a hall of mirrors and just having to take these little reflections of her in the lives of others. So that was a big part of it. And, you know, I think I also just learned that people really are hungry for real stories and real lives that aren't famous lives. Because I think what that affirms in us as readers is that all of our lives have value. It's not just about the presidents and the people who wrote the great books. And it's about accepting complexity and failure in human lives that came before us. And there's a real hunger for that.
Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham, written by Emily Bingham, who I've been speaking with. You can learn more about the book and Emily's work at wvxu.org. And as I said, it is quite the tale. And Emily, thank you very much for sharing, as I said, just a few of the stories about your great aunt, and greatly appreciate your time this morning.
You're welcome. I hope everyone can be more irrepressible.
Indeed. This is The Book Club at 91.7. You've been listening to The Book Club at 91.7. Technical director is Bruce Ellis. Producer is Kevin Reynolds. Music director and segment engineer is Rick Andres. Web guru is Jim Nolan. The announcer is Robin Carey Allgaier. And I'm Mark Purcell. On the next Book Club at 91.7, Hell from the Heavens, the epic story of the USS Laffey in World War II's greatest kamikaze attack. In the space of 80 minutes, 22 kamikaze planes attacked the Laffey. And how music got free, the end of an industry, the turn of the century, and the patient zero of piracy. I hope you'll be here for The Book Club at 91.7 next Saturday morning. Stay tuned for Weekend Edition just ahead on 91.7 WVXU.